Good morning. Never ceases to amaze me that there can be nobody sitting out there, and then we sort of fill it up. Welcome. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. If this is one of your first times, we will give you a chance to introduce yourself a little bit later on in the service. Prairie aspires to be a welcoming congregation. We welcome you no matter your ethnicity, your sexual orientation, your gender, your abilities, or not so many abilities in some areas, your hair color, whatever. Wherever you are on the road to, well, I was going to say on the religious journey, but I'll say that. Wherever you are on life's journey, we welcome you. If this is one of your first times here, we encourage you to come more than once because our services are very different. Sometimes I do the services. I am Sandy Ingham, Prairie's minister. Sometimes someone from within the congregation will do the service, and often we have people from outside the congregation. The opening words are by Howard Thurman, one of my heroes. In the quietness of this place, surrounded by the all-pervading presence of the holy, my heart whispers, keep fresh before me the moments of my high resolve, that in good times or in tempests, I may not forget that to which my life is committed. Keep fresh before me the moments of my high resolve. To face the world's coldness, a chalice of warmth. To face the world's terrors, a chalice of courage. To face the world's turmoil, a chalice of peace. May its glow fill our spirits, our hearts, and our lives. I have two short readings about ethics. The first one is by Van Cleve Morris. I was not familiar with this person. He writes, at the very core of the human being operates the power of choice. And it is this power of choice that sets us off as persons. It is this power of choice that must decide not only what is true, but what criteria should be used to determine truth, and what standards shall be used in deciding between competing criteria, and what judgments shall be employed in deciding on the standards, ad infinitum. Human choice is the ultimate court of judgment, both in morals and in practical judgment. It rules between competing choices of moral actions, but it also rules on what moralities shall be pursued in making judgments and what meta-moralities shall be used in deciding which morality is best, ad infinitum. Ultimately, when all the shams of reason, and he capitalizes these four words, reason, nature, science, God, when all the sham of those four things have been stripped away, there stand you and I, our choosing selves, naked before a cosmos of alternatives, trying to plot our way through it, and thus to give substance and essence to the idea of humanity, the capital H. And from Bertrand Russell, in his 1935 essay, The Harm That Good Men Do, Bertrand Russell writes, 100 years ago, there lived a philosopher named Jeremy Bentham, who was universally recognized to be a very wicked man. I remember to this day the first time that I came across his name when I was a boy. It was in a statement of the Reverend Sidney Smith to the effect that Bentham thought people ought to make soup of their dead grandmothers. This practice appeared to me as undesirable from a culinary as well as a moral point of view. And I therefore conceived a bad opinion of Bentham. Long afterwards, writes Russell, I discovered that the statement was one of those reckless lies in which respectable people are wont to indulge in the interests of virtue. I also discovered what was really the serious charge against him, Bentham. It was no less than this, that he defined a good, quotes, a good man as a man who does good. We can stop right there. We can just ponder that. Well, some of you may know this if you read your Prairie Fire, which of course you all do, right? Beginning to end. Okay. But over the past few months, we have been offering BYOT classes, or perhaps more accurately, discussions here at Prairie. BYOT stands for Building Your Own Theology, and is a series of adult religious education programs in which participants are encouraged to write their own credo, or their belief systems, based on what they believe about the big questions of life, or what Universalist Unitarian minister and creator of the BYOT series, Richard Gilbert, refers to as the great conversation. You know those questions. What is the meaning of life? What is death? Why do we die? Why do bad things happen to good people? And vice versa. What is evil? Is there evil? The questions that you, if you were fortunate enough to have gone to college and stayed in a dorm or a house with others, those questions that you stayed up all night talking about, which, by the way, still happens at General Assembly. Well, maybe not all night, we're older. Or perhaps if you've been lucky enough to have friends in your life with whom you can talk about the big questions. I have mentioned before that in ninth grade, my best friend, Karen, and I would bicycle out to a big rock, which was called Big Rock, along the Allegheny River in northwest Pennsylvania, in the town where we lived, and we would talk and talk and talk about how we were going to solve the problems of the world. We were going to end war. We didn't understand why adults were so stupid and just couldn't get along. We're still working on this. And Karen has become a Jehovah's Witness, and I have become a Unitarian Universalist minister, so there you go. I suspect that I may leave you with more questions than answers this morning, but that's okay. In the July issue of Prairie Fire, our monthly newsletter, I wrote that I borrowed the title of this morning's reflections from Richard Gilbert, who is responsible for that BYOT curriculum, as I said. Gilbert, in turn, came across the phrase, good for nothing, in a Ziggy cartoon, he claims, in which Ziggy says, I always heard if you were real good all your life, you'd be rewarded. So far, I've been good for nothing. Having grown up in the Christian tradition, specifically as a Presbyterian, I was steeped in the concept of predestination. When I went to college, I began to question that doctrine. Actually, I began to question that doctrine when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, that wonderful age. That's why we confirm kids at that age. That's why we want to grab them and teach them other things, maybe. It predestination just didn't take with me. And so by the time I got into college and had a semester or two, I chose to simply ignore the concept of predestination. As an adult, and many years after leaving the Presbyterian tradition, I had several conversations with Presbyterian ministers when attending my church of origin during visits to my parents in the small town in Pennsylvania where I was born and raised. And they attended that church almost their entire lives. If God has already decided who is going to heaven and who will go to that other place, why bother to be good? I have never received a satisfactory answer to this question. Coming out of such a strong Calvinist background, I find this question more intriguing and meaningful than the reverse. If you, and you can be referred to atheists, agnostics, humanists, Unitarian Universalists in general, if you don't believe in God or some higher authority, then why bother to be good? In the section of the BYOT series about ethics, Reverend Gilbert asks us to think about that and to consider what it is that underpins our ethics and our morals if we don't believe that we humans answer to a higher authority. What exactly does it mean to be ethical, to have morals? The dictionary definition of ethical is what you would expect it to be, of or related to ethics. So of course, you know, then we go to the word ethic, and it was originally singular. It's now almost always used in the plural. Ethic is defined as one, the discipline dealing with what is good and bad and with moral duty and obligation, and two, a set of moral principles or values. Moral is defined as one, relating to principles of right and wrong in behavior, two, expressing or reaching a conception of right behavior. The words ethics and morals, are used interchangeably, I mean. Though it seems to me that ethic or ethical standards, that's the umbrella and under which we put our morals, where we store our morals, but I will probably just be using them interchangeably. So umbrella would be the broad principle and the morals would be the procedures. Note how cleverly I worked those two words, policies and procedures, in. Very important words, and your board is working very hard on policies and procedures. Gilbert says that ethics, at its simplest, is the way we treat people. He goes on to talk about a moral compass, and I'll say more about that in a few minutes. Gilbert wonders how many of us would agree with these words from Walter Harrington in what Gilbert calls a cynical essay, "Has Truth Gone Out of Style?" This was published in 1988, but I think it's still relevant, in the Washington Post. Harrington writes, "Expediency, whatever sells, is the final test. This is what modern people have sadly concluded. Greed is the universal motive. Sincerity is a pose. Honesty is for chumps. Altruism is selfishness with a neurotic twist, and morality is for kids and saints and fools." End of quote. Is this cynical or simply realistic? Whether you believe this or not, you might agree that Western civilization is becoming more and more secular, despite all the religious fanaticism on either end. No, we don't do fanaticism on the right side. Or perhaps because of religious fanaticism. Now, I'm not trying to put a judgment here on whether it's good or bad that we seem to be becoming more secular, but I think most of us would agree to that. But then there's certain questions that I do wonder about. As nations and societies become more secular, does it necessarily follow that values, ethics, morals get lost by the wayside? As fewer and fewer people go to church, or have a faith community, however you want to define it, does it follow that more and more people are only out for themselves? That money and the acquisition of things become more and more important? Does it follow that the importance of money and material possessions increases as the number of people attending mainstream churches decreases? And the number of people attending so-called mainstream churches, Lutheran, Methodist, Presbyterian, some Baptist, on and on, is decreasing. We Unitarian Universalists are not usually lumped in there as mainstream. We're at the other end. And we tend to grow as times get worse in the country. Remember that in November. I don't know if this is what is happening. But does that also mean that fewer and fewer people are good for nothing? If you turn to the very beginning pages in the hymnal, page Roman numeral 10, although it's not marked, it's a page that I often refer to when I'm talking about our seven principles. It's right before the first, it's a page or two before the first hymn. If you go to that page, you will see that after the seventh principle, there is this statement: the living tradition we share draws from many sources. And the third source listed is wisdom from the world's religions, which inspires us in our ethical and spiritual life. Ethics, dealing with what is good and bad, simply put, how we treat people. Who determines what is good and bad? Who determines what is right behavior? Can human nature be changed? Are you born with a set of ethics and a moral compass? And from what authority do your ethics derive? Do you think of yourself as an ethical person, a moral person? Do you do the right thing because it is the right thing to do? Would you do the right thing if no one was watching? Some of you may sometimes receive emails. I think I get some of these from my son. At the bottom it says dance as if no one was watching and yada yada. And then I think it says act as if no one is watching or something. Or maybe it says act as if everyone is watching. I don't know. Do you have to have a witness for your good behavior? Who taught you ethics? Or did you just always have them? Can you describe your ethics clearly and concisely? What grounds them? How do your ethical and moral beliefs play out in your everyday lives? And have your ethics changed over the years? And would you die for your ethical beliefs? Would you give them up if you were tortured? Gilbert talks about this moral compass that has 8 points, and he puts a label on each point and then says that these can help us make ethical decisions. His 8 points are authority, motivation, responsibility, situation, intention, relationships, values, and character. Well, there's not time right now to even begin to go into all of them. I want to concentrate on just one of them right now, and that would be relationships. In Gilbert's words, the traditional Western view of ethics stresses obedience to rules or adherence to principles. Some consider this view too narrow and think that the real focus of morality is the bonding quality of relationships, and that in general, men view morality in terms of rights and women view it in terms of relationships. Men view morality in terms of rights and women see it in terms of relationships. I describe this as being in right relationship, and I've talked to you before about being in right relationship, but I'm never sure if I'm explaining it clearly enough anyway. An extreme example of not being in right relationship would be the relationship between a Nazi SS soldier and a prisoner in a concentration camp. There's a Simon Wiesenthal tells a wonderful, it's not wonderful, but an intriguing story about being in a concentration camp, being called into the room, a very nice hospital room, or nice compared to the rest of the camp, and the prisoner is dying. Some of you may know this story. It's from Wiesenthal's book, Sunflower, which is excruciating to read. And the young man, the Nazi soldier, is dying. He wants a Jew's forgiveness. So he asks Wiesenthal. More about that some other Sunday. A more ordinary example of not being in right relationship would be having a family member who won't or doesn't talk to you for whatever reason or reasons. I know this personally, and I also know that some of you are or have experienced this. It is way more common than you could probably imagine, which doesn't make it any less sad or even tragic. There is a wonderful Jewish parable from the Middle Ages that speaks to this concept of being in right relationship, and some of you will be familiar with this story. A rabbi spoke with God about heaven and hell. "I will show you hell," said God. And they went into a room which had a large pot of stew in the middle. The smell was delicious. But around the pot sat people who were famished and desperate. All were holding spoons with very long handles, which reached to the pot. But because the handles of the spoons were longer than their arms, it was impossible to get the stew back into their mouths. "Now I will show you heaven," God said. And they went into an identical room. There was a similar pot of stew, and the people had identical spoons, but they were well nourished and happy. "It's simple," God said. "You see, they have learned to feed one another." To be in right relationship with another requires compassionate connection. Philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer talked about, I need help, Mitleid, M-I-T-L-E-I-D?
Mitleid.
Now, the way Gilbert defines it is suffering with. If you want to go into more detail later, you can. A concept that seems to me to go deeper than that phrase we hear so often about walking a mile in the other person's shoes. I think Mitleid defines it much better, if we can manage to define it. This kind of suffering with compassion is what Lucia K.B. Hall says forms the foundation of ethics. Hall wrote an article in the Humanist magazine in the 90s, I believe, saying ethics cannot be derived from religious authority or from reason, but is biologically based in empathy. This ability to feel as another person feels, to be able to put yourself in their emotional situation, even to wince involuntarily when someone bangs their funny bone. This is the link that binds the human race together, that makes us care about how we act toward others. I've said this before in the past months, but more than once over the past several months, I have read about studies that confirm what Hall is writing in this essay from the early 90s, that we humans have an ingrained natural sense of empathy for other beings, well, at least other human beings. It is biologically based and has been evolving, at least that's where the studies seem to be headed. It has been evolving within us, maybe forever, to help make us ever more compassionate. Do women tend to see ethics and morals in terms of relationships, while men view them more in terms of rights and principles? Well, we could talk about that for a very long time. Do your ethics and morals sustain you in times of need? Do you rely on an outside source for that sustaining, or do you find that sustaining from within? I sometimes turn to the universalist part of our tradition to find stories of our ancestors to sustain me. And one such story, some of you will know, is about Hosea Ballou. He was a 19th century universalist preacher. He was very well known in his times. He, of course, because he was a universalist with a capital U, was preaching about universal salvation. And one day he was riding the circuit on his horse in New Hampshire when he was actually with a Baptist minister that afternoon, and they were arguing theology as they traveled, which you might expect. And at one point, the Baptist looked over and said, "Brother Ballou, if I were a universalist, capital U, and feared not the fires of hell, I could hit you over the head, steal your horse and saddle, and ride away, and I'd still go to heaven." Hosea Ballou looked over at him and said, "If you were a universalist, the idea would never occur to you." So, they help. The forebears, the stories, the things that they believed. Philosopher and feminist Carol Gilligan, some of you might know that name, she wrote the book in a different voice. She was a research associate for Lawrence Kohlberg. Does that name ring any bells? Any philosophers out there? I was kind of hoping Matt Tedesco would be here today, because I'm mentioning so many philosophers. He wrote, Kohlberg, not Matt, The Philosophy of Moral Development. Well, Carol Gilligan was a research associate for Kohlberg, but she was also one of his harshest critics. Kohlberg's the one who came up with the Heinz dilemma. Any of you know the Heinz dilemma? You will, I think, when I tell you what it is. A man named Heinz didn't have enough money to buy drugs, necessary medication for his wife who was dying. And so he broke into the drugstore and stole the drugs. Was this ethical? Was this wrong? Kohlberg used these studies, asking this question, putting people in this case study, and concluded that, well, doesn't really matter what he concluded because it was all over the board. But Carol Gilligan said this was a faulty study because Kohlberg only talked to and interviewed men. And Gilligan said his findings then were flawed, and she used a couple of stories from the Bible to illustrate the difference between how men and women make ethical choices, and both of these are from the Old Testament. There's the one where God tells Abraham to kill his only son. Never understood this story. I mean, I understand the story, but the Abraham saying, okay, fine, going out, preparing to kill. Well, of course, Isaac is spared. The other story that Gilligan uses is the one where the two women go to King Solomon, both claiming that the baby they have with them is theirs. And finally, King Solomon says, fine, we'll just cut the baby in half. And, of course, the real mother then says, no, it's okay, she can take it. Then Gilligan did her own Heinz dilemma study. She asked a boy and a girl, they were about 11 or 12 years old, about stealing the drug to keep your loved one alive. The boy said that Heinz should indeed steal the drug. But he did have a good point, the boy. When Gilligan asked him why the life of Heinz's wife, who actually never has a name, maybe we could give her a name, was more important than the money the druggist would not receive if the drug was stolen. Of course, in the original Heinz dilemma, the druggist is charging way, way, way more than it costs him to make or buy the drug. Sound familiar? The boy said, you could get more money, but you couldn't get another wife. All right. Then the girl said, well, the girl didn't even consider property or law. She was only concerned with what would happen to Heinz and his wife if Heinz stole the drugs. What would happen if he got caught? What would happen when the wife needed more medicine? What would happen if Heinz was in jail? What would happen to this marriage? Wasn't there another way to figure out how to pay for the drugs? Is Heinz's dilemma about rights, or is it about responsibility to others? Richard Gilbert says, morality begins when concern for self gives way to concern for others. There's a whole nother part to this, so I think we're going to do part two, but not today, which has to do with a lot of things. And I should first say that there was more to my upbringing in the Presbyterian Church than that predestination part. There was a strong connection with Jesus. Jesus as compassionate connector, as a human being who understood that compassionate connections are what will save humanity, that our ethics have to ultimately be about relationship, not about rights and principles. The part that I'm not going to get into today is about reverence, and which is a word that is not to be confused with religion. I think even we atheists and humanists can have respect for the word reverence, which the word reverence actually means respect. To be in right relationship, you have to be aware of the world, of course, and aware of your place in it. And I think it's good to remember the how often do I say Fyodor Dostoevsky? Not often. In the Brothers Karamazov, he said, "Not all are guilty, but all are responsible," which I think is a really good quote to remember. And then this quote from the Unitarian Universalist Partner Church Council. They've been sending me information about this trip to Transylvania because they are going to be the ones who greet us and put us in homes, and I mean private homes, and take us away to the mountains and everything. This quote that I used a few weeks ago, "The most radical thing," and they capitalize the word radical, "the most radical thing we can do is to introduce people to one another." A Peanuts comic strip illustrates one way of being in relationship, but wrong relationship. Lucy rants, "I think it is possible to be too nice. By golly, nobody's gonna walk all over me. No, sir. If anybody's gonna do any walking, it's gonna be me. There's only one way to survive these days. You have to walk over them before they walk over you," says Linus to Charlie Brown. It must be nice to have a philosophy that will sustain you in times of need. Stillwater, the giant panda, taught the children, or showed, better yet, showed the children, a way to move out of wrong relationship and into right relationship. There is another book by John Muth, one that I have often used, The Three Questions. Some of you may remember my using this book, and it's based on a Tolstoy short story. And in this book, Muth asks the questions that Tolstoy did. Number one, and this is all about ethics, when is the best time to do things? Number two, who is the most important one? And number three, what is the right thing to do? And the answer, there's only one important time, that's now. The most important one is always the one you are with. And the most important thing is to do good for the one who is standing at your side. The challenge, of course, always is the challenge, is to enlarge who is the number of people standing at your side. This could be a metaphor, but to enlarge it beyond this room and beyond Unitarian Universalism, even. Not all are guilty, but all are responsible. That quote has helped me somewhat grapple with some of the tragedy that we talked about, the specific tragedies of the last few weeks. Orlando, St. Paul, Dallas, you know them. So next Sunday I will be in Transylvania, that hotbed of ethical and moral dilemma in the 1500s. I will be there being introduced to Unitarian Romanians, and I wish that all of you were going with me. You'll certainly be with me in spirit, and you'll probably hear a bit about the trip. go in peace, greet your neighbor, do all those things. Try to keep next week straight in your mind, next Sunday.